We continue with Eben Moglen. He's talking about Freedom Boxes, which is basically a little computer which will manage all the encryption between you and your friends. And it'll do so in a secure way, which will mean that even if a third party can collect all the data, can spy on what you're sending to your friends, they still won't be able to make sense of it. This has got obvious implications for a system something like Facebook. It would be fairly easy, using the system, to make a Facebook equivalent, but one which wasn't controllable, which couldn't be monitored and tampered with from a single point, Facebook HQ, but which left you in charge of your data. This is more or less the vision that I had a decade or so ago, which presaged my understanding that money, in its current form, is a Facebook equivalent. There are some privileged parties, i.e. commercial banks, who get to decide how much money everybody's got. And generally, they do their stated business of managing these accounts, keeping it a zero-sum game so that you can only get money, bank credit from someone else who's got it, and occasionally somebody taps them on the shoulder and says, so-and-so is a troublemaker, we'd like you to freeze his account, withdraw services from this person. And of course we know they use their position in the hierarchy as masters of bank credit to extract a certain percentage, which they call interest, which is perhaps better understood as tribute, which, if you want to use their system, you are forced to give them. Now, what would be the implications of a system which didn't have central authorities in charge, where no one person could control anyone else's accounts? This is the altruistic economics model, and it is a confusing model, especially if you're used to the way that money normally works. Now, this naturally raises certain questions, such as, well, how could somebody be in charge of their own account? Wouldn't they cheat? Well, that's an important question, but it's one I'm going to leave for another episode when we get back to altruistic economics. This is Eben Moglen, who doesn't get as far as money. He's looking at the basic computer architecture and the need to get beyond the client-server mentality, where the mass of individuals basically have a client and its central authorities, large companies, Facebook, governments, banks, who provide the servers which manage all the information. This presentation is entitled, Can We Be the Silver Lining in the Cloud?
Obviously, Eben Moglen probably doesn't need much of an introduction to this audience, but still I'd like to highlight a few things. He's a law professor here at Columbia University since 1987. He's also the founder and chairman of the Software Freedom Law Center. So obviously, as a professor, he's spent many, many years training generations of lawyers to kind of intervene in the world in the realm of privacy and copyright. Some people may not know, he's also got a very kind of strong historical edge to his work. He has a PhD from Yale University in history. However, as much as Eben has worked as a professor for many, many years, he's quite interested in changing and intervening directly in the world. He has provided pro bono work to the Free Software Foundation since 1993. He was on Phil Zimmerman's legal counsel team for PGP. He founded the Software Freedom Law Center, had a direct role, obviously, in shaping the GPL3. So all these things are obviously incredibly important. But for anyone who has seen him speak, he also tends to inspire all sorts of people who are not his students to follow kind of in the way of free software. And I think today we are confronting some interesting challenges when it comes to software freedom. And this is what Eben will be talking about today. So please join me in welcoming Eben Moglen today.
It's an honor to be here. Since early in Bo, it has been the case that every single day There's been at least one computer in my life running Debian, and I couldn't begin without thanking you. It's a great pleasure to me that DebConf has come to New York at least once, probably once. Having spent almost a quarter of a century teaching in this university, it's a particular pleasure for me to see you here. I want to talk this morning about technology and politics. And I want to talk about technology and politics in the mode where technology can help fix politics, which is good, because if we expect politics to fix technology, we will, of course, wait forever and be deeply disappointed. So the line of direction, if we mean to support freedom, is not a line from politics to technology, but a line from technology to politics. That's what time ago, that's what Phil Zimmerman saw a long time ago, that's what our client base at the Software Freedom Law Center thinks, that you, and the question is, how do we take political analysis and turn it into technological problems and be solved? And that's what I want to do. I've been thinking a good deal start a year away from teaching, which is the moment when, as an academic, you can begin to do some thinking. I've been thinking a lot this year, in preparation for a year away from teaching, about the lamentable state of privacy in the network, and about the extent to which, though we have been working steadily with extraordinary results for a generation now towards technology to support freedom, we are also watching as the network grows up in a way we've all been afraid of, as a great surveillance instrument that can be used for forms of control over people's lives that are far too powerful for us to permit. The network is doing the very things that we're afraid it can be made to do. And indeed, a certain application layer, I hesitate to call them developments, let's just say events, like Facebook, have created far more serious concerns for the network's possibilities as an instrument of surveillance and control than the ones we thought we were worrying about when we started worrying about proprietary technology and freedom. The problem is that proprietary technology's threat to freedom consisted of the possibility that people would be trapped in a technological environment they didn't understand, couldn't reason about, and couldn't modify to the extent necessary to preserve their own personal liberties. The problem with the net that we have now, in addition to all of that, is that people are induced to give away everything that is crucial to the maintenance of their autonomy in return for vastly overpriced services, which cost nothing in monetary terms, but which are not just unfree, but are productive of unfreedom. We have social networking that spies on you all the time. We have email delivery, which is extremely capacious and spies on you all the time. We have free telephony services supported by advertising based on the content of what you're talking about. It's a rather bad universe from the point of view of freedom. It's a bad universe because it incorporates all of the things which worried us about the possibilities of proprietary software, plus one more, namely that people can be fooled into doing themselves very substantial long-term harm, and not just harm to themselves, but harm to the ecology of information protection, in return for people giving them, at monetary cost zero, stuff that degenerates freedom, but which also provides them features that they want. This is a challenge not merely of a technical kind, that is to say, technical from a lawyer's point of view. No binaries are being distributed so the GPL doesn't kick in so you don't get the source code. It's past that. I mean, that's true. And that's a reason for the Franklin Street Statement and a reason for the AGPL and a reason for specific concern about the licensing of software that performs service provision in a network. But it goes way beyond that. It's a matter of bad technology design. In early February at NYU, I gave a talk about the beginnings of my thinking on this subject called Freedom in the Cloud. And this morning, though I don't want to leave anybody behind who didn't happen to hear that tedious recitation of trouble, I want to take the thinking a little bit past that, because it's time for some engineering and we're the people who are going to do it. The basic difficulty, in my view, the reason that we have wound up with a net which, despite the extraordinary penetration of free software into it, is still in the growth curve phase of hurting freedom. The reason that we're there is that we have allowed an architectural myth about the net to grow strong. The net was built as a collection of peers with equal power. And it became, over time, a network based on master-client, server-client, master-servant relationships of hierarchy. That hierarchical design had in part to do with the architectural premises of the Microsoft monopoly, which tended always to think in server-client terms, not because those were essential to the technology or even really because they were essential to the Microsoft platform management business model, although that was relevant, but mostly just because it was the culture of an institution which had very rigid culture, which is part of why it is now dying. But that server-client view of the network also made some sense in a world where large iron and small iron behave differently. And it sort of made sense to think of large iron as doing large iron work serving small iron, where small iron wasn't really thought of as stuff that fits in a pocket, but stuff that lives on a tabletop. And all of our considerations about the network have become imbued with technological assumptions, inarticulate most of the time, barely glimpsed, except out of the corner of our eye, we assume a hierarchical net, even we assume a hierarchical net, with heavy iron doing serving and lighter iron out there being clients and doing conceptually different things. We are now about to take another architectural step in the history of our technology. This is the step which is being referred to as the cloud. A very cloudy phrase, which basically means iron doesn't matter anymore. It could be anywhere. The cloud is the location independence and virtualization of iron. That's what it means in some fundamental sense if you're trying to cut through the jargon. And what that means to most of the people thinking about the cloud as a business proposition is we're going to have a hierarchical network in which the real hierarchs are invisible, virtual, non-existent, movable, flexible, can disappear and appear anywhere at the convenience of whoever it is who manages the hierarchs. Which is a convenience, no question about it, and capable of saving enormous money in the IT expenses of large businesses, and will happen, therefore, because capitalism needs it, and there's nothing intrinsically wrong with it. In fact, it may save energy, move jobs to better place, God knows, all sorts of things. But what it will do, unless we begin to intervene in how it does it, what it will do is make freedom even harder to preserve. Because people's data will go someplace they don't control at all, and there will be an open scrum to control it. This week, as you are noticing, the UAE is playing tough with RIM over why you don't let small countries like us bug everybody who uses a BlackBerry just as much as you let big countries, where your servers are, bug people who use BlackBerries. Which is really, oddly enough, a complaint about freedom in the cloud by a government whose secret police don't have enough of it anymore. Right? And is, much as I don't generally sympathize with the spooks and the cops and the listeners, on this particular case, my heart goes out to them because they're having the cloud problem. The thing is that at the end of the day, we don't really care whether the secret police have a cloud problem. We care whether human beings have a cloud problem. And it's going to grow worse as everybody's hierarchically organized net moves towards servers that go wherever they are going to be least effectively controlled by you and least effectively controlled by law in the interest of those people who have de facto control because they have your data and they run your processes. This is a very bad outcome. Fortunately, we're the free software movement. That means not only do we make great software, but we think about problems exactly like this, and we try to solve them, preferably before they happen, and if necessary, after they happen. And we've been doing it for a long time. 20 years ago, when, as Biela points out, almost 20, 19 this summer, 20 years ago, when the question was, can you use mass market, freely developed, freely transmissible, strong encryption, the most powerful organizations in the world, like the United States government, wanted the answer to be no. We recognized back then that two things were true. Without freely available industrial strength encryption, people control, two things can't happen. One, freedom, and two, electronic commerce. And we said that to everybody, and we were told, no, you're in favor of nuclear terrorism and pedophilia. In fact, back when I was working for Phil Zimmerman, I had a bet with one of the lawyers on the beat. At every public event where I showed up to talk about it, we bet a dime whether the first thing that was going to be said about me that particular day was nuclear terrorism or pedophilia. And we're talking about the early 90s, before the vast hysteria really began. So we've been trying to think ahead about what would be necessary in order to prevent harm to freedom for a generation now. And although the scoreboard is quite uneven, we've done reasonably well. Most importantly, we have built profound capacity. And when I say we, I mean you. We've got real tools for improving freedom in the net. At the moment, we have profound challenges, and I've just quickly tried to describe them here. Those who are interested in a more detailed analysis can go back to the transcript or the video of the Freedom in the Cloud talk, where I tried to spell it out in more detail. But today, I don't want to get to starting line. Today, I want to get past the starting line. Here's the situation about the cloud. Servers can be anywhere, and they can be anything. They can be made out of iron. They can be made out of bits. All they do is run programs that provide outputs to people who provide inputs over a network. Generally speaking, the physical or even virtual organization of the server cloud in the net in the next several years will support the business models of people selling services. They will, to some extent, support the business models of people selling hardware. They will, to some extent, support the business models of people selling software, but primarily they will support service-based business models. Provision of everything from data centers we wrap for you to your email in one great big inbox as long as we're allowed to read over your shoulder. But because servers can be anywhere, people interested in freedom might ask themselves, where should a server be whose goal is to make freedom for the human being who owns it? Where should a server be if its goal is to make freedom for the person who owns it? The answer is in his apartment, in her bedroom, in the places where law and society come together to agree that there is something called privacy and that you ought to have it. If your data is sitting in your desk drawer and in your house, and somebody in the world wants it, and your house is located in the United States, then they can get a search warrant. And if they can't get a search warrant, then they can't have it unless you want to give it to them. The enormous changes in our Fourth Amendment, which used to protect us in our papers and effects in lots of places, no longer protects us in an airport, on the street, at work, on the phone, in many of the ways we thought it did. But so far, And I believe for the foreseeable future, the constitutional sacredness of the home is not going away. And while not every society behaves with the same degree of recognition that a man's home is his castle, as the common law ditty puts it, everybody understands that that which you keep close is more yours to regulate and control than that which you voluntarily give away to a stranger to keep for you on another continent. So the server that protects your freedom should be in your house. Well, you've got lots of servers in your house. You've already solved this problem to the extent that you want it to be solved. It's solved already. But we make technology to free people who aren't us. So the server should be in somebody's house. But people are afraid of servers in their house. Servers in the house is some kind of high complexity thing that nobody older than 12 should ever do. Right? You have to be an expert, a genius, or a child. And not everybody is. So the server that works in your house to protect your freedom should be very inexpensive, very small, and very simple. In fact, it should basically be something you plug into the wall and forget. The server that protects your freedom should be, in the world of 2015, what a quaint, antique piece of technology called the telephone answering machine was to the 1980s. A commodity box you buy at every corner store at nearly no price. You bring it home, you plug it in, you do 2 minutes of setting up and record your favorite funny outbound message, and you leave it there. And you leave it there until, which is as long as most answering machines were, until the whole technology of society has made it no longer necessary for you to keep it, at which point you throw it away. That's the best possible model for the server that lives in your house and protects your freedom. Got to be cheap, got to be simple, got to be basically featureless. In fact, of course, the server that protects your freedom and lives in your house is no larger than the power supply for your answering machine. And when we are done with the project I'm going to propose we should be on, it will cost $25. So everybody can have one. Everybody can have one. And it's a consumer appliance. It's meant to be that simple that you don't have to be a 12-year-old. You could actually be a grown-up and still know how to use it. What should a server that lives in your house and protects your freedom do? Well, I was talking in February about how it should affect your social networking, which is actually among the most complex and least straightforward of the various things it ought to do. And I was starting there because I wanted to talk about the effect of social networking in the cloud on people's freedom. So what I set out there was we look at social networking and we see that we have a problem which we identify immediately as the problem presented by centralized services. Everybody's social life, 500 million people, should not be locked up in one big database that belongs to somebody else. It's a terrible idea. Everybody knows that. Mr. Zuckerberg knows it too. It's the magic of capitalism that says getting very rich by doing something that's very bad for everybody is a great idea and you should do it and become famous and a hero. Right? And that's okay. I mean, fine, right? Every system in the world has problems, and capitalism has this problem. And the thing to do about it isn't to overthrow capitalism and burn down the world, it's to fix this problem. Now, to be sure, Mr. Zuckerberg is part of the problem and not part of the solution. So I went and tried to talk on a Friday night to a bunch of young people at the other university on Manhattan Island that collects a lot of people with no dates on Friday night. And we try to imagine what it would mean to take social networking out of the server-client, master-slave architecture of the network. And a few guys in the audience said, yeah, this is a project we want to do, so let's think up how we want to do this. We want to have an API structure which solves the fundamental underlying problem of changing Facebook. If you're Facebook, if you're the guys around Zuckerberg or the guys salivating to take it public or whatever, you think that what protects your business is half a billion people are in a roach motel. They can't leave because their friends are there. And it's this inflexibility which is, from their point of view, strategically the underpinning of their inevitability. This is technically wrong. What the diaspora guys said was, how about we develop a system which provides encrypted peer-to-peer routes for social networking-like information, sharing of text and photos and conducting of real-world human intercommunications. And suppose we set it up through an aggregation interface which is insensitive to whether it is getting this particular photo from Flickr or over an encrypted route from a friend. As your friends switch to federated social networking, more and more of your interactions occur directly peer-to-peer over encrypted routes, and fewer of your interactions occur through the intermediary centralized services, but you never have to know, because every day you look through your aggregator, and every day you see all the stuff, and some of it is coming one way, and some of it is coming the other way, and as your friends begin to work through diaspora nodes, you all take a soft withdrawal from the centralized services. This is a very interesting business, as is demonstrated by the $200,000 raised on Kickstart in less than 4 weeks by a whole lot of people around the world who said, yeah, that's a really great idea. You're some smart young people with no track record and no code, but we're willing to bet a little bit on you. And a lot of little bits added up, and they're off writing some code, and we'll see what happens. But what I want to do right now is to focus a little bit more on other parts of the stack that may be a little more simple to think about and actually have also some very powerful effects on freedom. So you've got a server in your apartment. It knows about your mobile devices, and it talks to them in an authenticated way. So you can run your life from your mobile devices sensibly and without intermediaries who put you in any way at risk. That box is also your wireless router because it's got wireless and it's got a wired connection in whatever is the wired connection to your apartment, or it's part of some mesh if that's how you like to be. And it does backups for you in an encrypted form to your friends so that everybody is helping to make everybody's data more robust. And unless all your friends, including in the different places around the world where you have them, all disappear all at once, you can regenerate anything with a couple of key presses. It versions your stuff, which for many people in the world would be a shocking development. It encrypts your email. A thing we've made possible for people 20 years ago and people aren't doing, as a consequence of which a lot of stuff is stolen out of email far more than they even know. Never mind the government intervention. If you have friends who live in China or Syria or other places in the world, your box works to help them climb over the wall around where they live because it proxies for them. Your box is a cognitive radio on the net. That is to say, it senses its environment. Do you have an ISP who won't let you get to port 5678 on IP address so-and-so? Gee, that's a shame. Your box tunnels to a friend and bounces you the traffic. In other words, your box makes network neutrality for you. It can't do everything. It's not a replacement for sound regulation. But politics won't make freedom by technology most of the time, and technology can make freedom for politics sometimes. If you have de facto network neutrality because everybody's using these servers, no ISP can kick them off the net, it's out of the question, and they are cross-routing traffic to avoid difficulties, you will have fewer difficulties. Your server in your apartment should have asterisk in it. Now we begin to change the global economics of telephony deeply. And we begin to acquire some working power in dealing with parties who are very difficult for us and who are very important to our future. Let us call them AT&T, Verizon, Deutsche Telekom, BT, and Vodafone. Right? Because we begin to have alternatives. In fact, if we spread these cheap easy, simple, fun, useful boxes around the world, we will become the world's largest telephone company in a very short period of time. And we will begin to have things to say about the industry and how it works. All of this, and a lot more, can be done in a very featureful footprint the size of a power supply. It's the ARM-based plug server, right? We have many designs around the world right now, this year. Next year, or the year after that, they will be commodities. Their prices will drop precipitously. We are now talking about very good servers that consume less than 10 cubic centimeters and that are very cheap. They have significant processing power. They have significant available storage. You can USB connect anything in the world to them and make as much storage as you like. They are very intelligent routers. They can do lots of interesting things. The architecture is one Debian already supports. That's to say, we've got our whole toolkit already packed. We've got lots of software that we would need for such a project. Since I spoke in February, I've been receiving email from all over the world from people who have dozens of pieces. Guy writes to me and says, I live in a small Central American company behind 12 layers of IPv6 NAT, but I've got exactly the thing you want for your router privacy piece. And you know how it is. We're pulling together a stack. It's a stack whose job it is to provide Freedom appliance material to be used in a particular form factor, which is our form factor. The small server located under your physical control, which federates services with the people in your life with whom you wish to exchange privately and in a secure fashion, that's our iPhone. That's the form factor we want to be in. Most businesses around the world don't want that form factor. It doesn't help their business models. We will have allies. I am working to find us allies. They are people in portions of the world hardware business for whom disruption of dominant competitors would be a good thing. And if I say to them, there's commodity hardware out there you don't have to make, join to free software we already have, which will produce vast amounts of political liberty to its users and will really screw up your dominant competitor's business model, are you at all interested in helping? The diplomacy is doable. Let me put it that way. The diplomacy is doable. The crucial fact is that it's up to us to make the software, just as it was up to us to make PGP. Okay? Nobody's going to do it for us. Nobody's going to do it for us. No matter how obvious it is, no matter how good it would be for everybody, no matter how much better the world would be, if we don't do it, it won't get done. So we should do it. There are a few parts to this that we don't already have. We need a very extraordinary, fun experience web configuration business for how to get your little personal server up and running in a way that's good for you the first time. And we need to do even better than we have already done at making it easy for people to trust us with respect to feature updates and security services and all the other things that will be involved here. It needs to be a bring it home, plug it in, teach it what your cell phone is, set up the basic stuff, tell it where your friends are, and forget about it. It will just work for you. Kind of an operation. This is within our reach. This is the silver lining of the cloud. This is how we can take the very thing which is happening to the network, the dematerialization of the network. This is how we can use the dematerialization of the network to redress the unfortunate hierarchicalization which happened over the last 20 years. To return the net to a condition much more like peerage and to use that peerage in the interests of the peers, who are the people for whom we make the software. We are going to live in the year of the Linux desktop sooner or later. All right? I believe that too. I believe that too. And I think that's good. I think that's good. I think we used to think that was victory. It's not victory. In fact, whatever we do about that, and we will do really good things, and GNU will be there, and X will be there, and the Linux kernel will be there, and some other kernels will be there, and all kinds of stuff will run, and it will all be fantastic. But the really big social payoff for us right now, the really big social payoff for us right now is the small server that restores freedom. That begins to turn the net into a place of federated services because the infrastructure for federated services is already there and people are buying it and installing it because it's good for them, cheap, and gives them what they want. In my world, where the lawyers are, there are lots of people who say, yeah, give me that, I want to put it in my apartment, I want people to have to get a search warrant. There are other people out there who think, well, we really need a cloud of proxy servers to help our friends in countries that don't allow people to read freely. People need network neutrality. People need privacy. People need cheaper telephone calls. All kinds of things that people need that we can give them on a hardware platform that already exists and which we already support and which will otherwise not be used for politically advantageous purposes. Over the next few months, we want at SFLC to help pull together the necessary institutional and legal arrangements, and we want to find the technologists who want to help us do this work. The Freedom Box, as I am calling it right now, in default of something better and more catchy, the Freedom Box is a product for us. Not a product to sell and make money on, a product to spread through the world in order to get the promise of free software to people in a particularly advantageous way right now, at the moment where we don't have to do it by inventing hardware or software, we can just put together the off-the-shelf pieces that will do the job. I don't mean by saying just that it's either no technical challenge or no technical challenge worthy of the extraordinary people in this room. It is a technical challenge and it is worthy of the extraordinary people in this room. It is the shortest route, in my personal opinion, to major pro-freedom payoffs from free software in the near future. We can have a transformative effect on the network and on the evolution of connected society if we do this right. This is the time. We live now in a world of hardware heterogeneity. That's part of why the Microsoft monopoly is failing, because it doesn't run on everything. We run on everything. We are, for now, in the position that in a differently constructed universe, the alternate universe in which Richard Stallman grows up to be president of the United States but doesn't do free software programming, we are now living in a world in which the promise of technological freedom as a support for political freedom can be realized in a new and ingenious way because the box builders have done what they always do. They have built great boxes for us to do something with. These boxes are great because they are cheap, simple, and can be made ubiquitous. They can put power back into a better balanced net. If they put power back into a better balanced net, and we're the power of that net, then we will begin to have a net which actively sustains, supports, and implements freedom inside people's apartments every day. This is the game we should be shooting for, along with all the other games we're shooting for. Maybe there are 10 projects we need now we haven't already got, and some glue. But this is eminently reachable. This is eminently reachable. And it isn't merely that social networking will stop spying on you, and it isn't merely that you'll get all the email convenience you want with nobody looking over your shoulder. It isn't merely that the net will become more neutral, or that people in China will read, or that there will be enough Tor nodes for performance finally not to be horrendous. It's all of that and a lot of other stuff we haven't even thought of yet, but that we'll figure out as we begin to do the work. So that's what I came to talk about. I want to spend the next several months trying to find other things that we can do to help make this suddenly happen. And believe me, to the rest of the world, it will happen very suddenly. We will disrupt a lot of games we would like to have disrupted, and we will win a lot of credit for ourselves and for freedom. So that's what I wanted to say today. I'm happy to take your questions. Thank you very much.
And I had to cut some of the questions because I wanted to fit this into an hour, and the total is slightly over. So we continue with the selection of the Q&A.
Hello, thank you for your talk. I have a question. One of the things that has pushed me kind of towards the cloud, or at least towards the data center, are the somewhat usurious agreements that ISPs enforce upon you not to serve any services from your house. And I was wondering what your suggestions are and how we can battle that.
Remember that you've asked a question which is global, and any answer which I give you is local. In some parts of the world, I can say the market is a useful instrument for altering the behavior of market participants because people can vote with their feet. In some parts of the world, I can say we have regulatory options. But mostly what I can say to you is using personal encryption was against the law in many places in 1991. May I just randomly think of France, for example? And the movement of encryption software was forbidden in many places, including this one on the export side. And we actually found it necessary at one point to print the source code of PGP 2.0 in a hardbound book published by the MIT Press, in order, which published, I think it was a whole 50 copies. I have one if anybody ever wants to see it. Which we took to the United States government through the Commerce Department window, and we said, well, here's a book. Do you want to tell us that we're not allowed to export this book from the United States because of some law or other? We'd really like to have a First Amendment conversation in the courts about that, if that's what you think. And they gave us a commodities jurisdiction certificate for the book. So what I guess I want to say is, I actually think of this device as an electric cattle prod capable of being used with respect to certain ISPs, okay? Let's rumble. Do you really want to say you want to enforce your... Imagine that the telephone company had, before the breakup of AT&T, said, we're going to cut off the telephone service of everybody with an answering machine. What would have happened? So I think the way to deal with the problem, in other words, is to face it really, really squarely. I don't think the cable companies in New York City want to say, you can't have the magic Freedom Box, go buy your bandwidth from Verizon. And I don't think they really want to say, you can't have a magic Freedom Box unless you mesh network it with the guy in the apartment next to you who doesn't use our services. I think Best Buy, which now owns Speakeasy in the United States, but which is doing its very best never to be seen with Speakeasy because it knows it wouldn't be good for Speakeasy's business. I don't think Best Buy wants to turn Speakeasy into an oppressive ISP. I think they want to leave it there for the people who want to buy those services. So I don't want to say this is not a problem. I just want to say I think the Freedom Box helps to fix it instead of keep it from happening.
Hi. Thank you for your talk. As you mentioned, trying to, we all have servers at home, and I think we have all been trying to do some of this work ourselves for a long time and struggling to bring the internet back to its natural form. My question is, a lot of the work we're doing is isolated and disparate and not coordinated, and I think it has a grave effect over the way those developments are happening. Are you proposing some coordinating structure or some way of pushing this forward in a common fashion, or are you simply relying on the common energy that we can pull out?
No, I'm proposing coordination. I'm proposing that this is a Debian in little. It's another sub-distribution. It's a stack made out of our parts, thought about and governed in our way democratically, capable of producing self-organization for the making of software, capable of supporting architecture and supporting use and engaging users and bringing people into active relationship to the software who've only begun as users of the software. I'm suggesting we go and do the full Monty with this.
Excellent. That is what I was expecting. Thank you.
Apple creates desire for I'm free because it employs highly skilled graphic, industrial, and interaction designers. And free software projects do not typically engage those communities as hobbyists. So I wonder what extent those skills are needed to achieve the mass popularity that you envision. And if those skills are needed, how you suggest the free software community can engage with those kinds of people.
Well, you know, not without reason, some people have commented on how much better their stuff looks. Some people remember that part of that reason is because they have patents on how to make stuff look good and they won't share them with us. And we spent years worrying about how to do things that we could have done if Steve had been as generous with us as we were with him. But notice that what I've said is that the platform whose time has come is a platform that doesn't have a screen, doesn't have a mode of interaction directly with its owner, and is beige, small, and in fact could be made, pardon me, by HP, except that it would be delivered to you with 20 layers of cardboard and styrofoam. Right? I mean, this does not call upon us to worry about whether we are good enough at making cute, shiny things. This calls upon us to make what we are really good at, which is powerful stuff that just works, never breaks, does what it's supposed to do, and makes things easy for you. It will wind up with a UI, but that UI will be made of CSS, right? It's just going to talk to you over whatever it is that you use to talk to things in the net. It's just going to be yours. And I'm sure it will skin in the end in all the ways that everything does. But people won't buy because it's pretty. People will buy because their wireless router broke, and this is cheaper than a wireless router and does 200 other things. And everybody's got one. And oddly enough, it's cool, even though it doesn't look it. You're correct, of course, that Apple will never make this product, because no matter how much shininess you put on it, it's still just a beige box. And that's the good part. We're in a different product cycle than he is now. Isn't that sweet?
Hi. So technology is gradually converging on science fiction. I don't know if you've read your talk brought to mind, Verne Vinge's Rainbow's End, for me. And one of the nightmares there is that we did this, but the US government beat us. Before we got as far as making it work, we were federally mandated to include something very much akin to the Clipper chip in all of these boxes. So, you know, everything only operates within a sandbox. Is the only way that we can defeat this to be quick, to get there first?
No, but it doesn't hurt. Making facts on the ground is a good idea. PGP came from Phil Zimmerman's determination that if S1 passed and encryption became illegal to use in the United States, as it was already in France, there would be free software doing strong encryption out there in the world, and they'd have to get it back in. I have to tell you that I'm not as worried as you are about a Clipper chip, because the Clipper chip proved to government what will happen if it does the Clipper chip. What we are actually going to be doing if we do this is doing the United States government an immense favor, because we're going to provide a superb addition to network security without costing the United States government the one thing it doesn't ever want to do, which is to come out and tell people there will never be a secure network while there is Windows. This is an open understanding. Everybody knows it. You can't really study the problem without noticing that Windows made the secure net a mere theory. But the United States government isn't going to do that, so it can't tell the truth. So what it will do is waste tens of billions of dollars on cyber war in order to keep people employed without really addressing the problem. NSA knew that when they tried to get security-enhanced Linux to exist and were willing to face down very serious Microsoft pushback over the idea of contributing to free software to improve general network security. Now we, if we put freedom boxes in people's houses, will give them appropriate perimeter security for the first time. We will give them IDS for free. And I don't mean IDS that spies on you for free. I mean IDS that tries to keep the spies out of your apartment for free. And we will put a ring around Windows boxes that will make the botnet inside your house less of a problem to you and the world outside. In fact, over a while, those botnets will get better because more bots will be behind filtration. The government is not going to fight us about this. There are too many easy ways to stop the fight. If we had the software now and the boxes now, I would be standing here telling you, don't worry, I can protect you.
You say that this box is not going to need a shiny UI or whatever, it's just a beige box that sits in the corner. One of the reasons that people use these services that we're objecting to here is because they like the UI. So people all use Gmail because it has a very nice way of accessing their email and doing all the features that they want with their email. Whereas when you look at the webmail things which are currently available in open source, you know, people don't use these in some cases because they don't have a server to run them on, but a lot of cases because, you know, they don't have these features and they aren't as polished. And the same with things like Facebook. You know, there isn't the equivalent in open source, largely for probably the reason that these companies can hire the people to produce really nice and slick and usable systems. So if this Freedom Box is going to sit there and handle all of your encryption, aren't people just going to then send the emails back over to Gmail once they've come into the Freedom Box and send all of their images over to Facebook and this sort of thing, because it's got a much nicer interface and thus undo all of the good work?
Well, since I don't use Facebook, I'm at a disadvantage. I rarely hear people tell me how pretty it is. My impression is that's not the reason. Similarly, although it may be true that Gmail is basically in use for prettiness, I think it's in use because it's convenient as hell for people. And when I ask the free software hackers who go to law school and sit in my classroom and take the class on privacy, the Constitution, and computers why they run Gmail, Louis Villa says, no, I don't know, it's just so easy. Louis Villa? It's one of the most shocking moments in my classroom in the past 10 years, aside from the people who now believe in the efficacy of torture, is Lewis sitting in there and telling me, you know, it's too much trouble running a mail server, I'd rather use Gmail. Now he's a lawyer for Mozilla. I don't know whether he's changed his attitude about that or not. You ask him the next time you see him, tell him I sent you. You may be right, and if it turns out that pretty is what we need, then pretty is what we'll make. Web design is not... We don't have to feel really all that guilty. We know how to make nice web design. It's okay. We have nice websites. If you're right, and that turns out to be what we have to do, then that's what we have to do, and we have to do it. I don't actually think that's the first and most important part of gaining acceptance for this. I think cheap stuff that really works good and is better than your router, than your existing wireless router, is smaller, uses less, and costs less, and fits under your desk more conveniently, is really the selling point for some people. As all my data in my apartment, where you have to get a warrant, is for some people. Diaspora or something like it that gives you privacy-respected social networking will be the selling point for other people. And, you know, since we don't have to sell the boxes and make a profit on it, I don't actually care. All I really want is for us to make the software, which is immortal and will never die, and let other people make the boxes and sell them for money, which they will do, and we will help them because we will give people a wonderful way to use their products, which they will advertise. So let's see how it goes. I understand what you're saying, and it might be right. But I don't want us to get into the view that we are tyrannized by the pretty. We need to be aware of design. We need to think about design. We need to care about design. But what we really need to care about is technology and freedom.
And we just got a couple of minutes left in which I'd like to play the soundtrack of a video called The Grassroots Economy of 2018. Now, they're not talking about decentralizing money. That, I think, will be the seminal change in social organization this century. But they are talking about person-to-person interaction in a more free fashion than is currently permitted through these centrally organized hierarchies. So this is, if we leave money aside, how things might be different, where it's not up to large companies to direct what goes on, but large networks of individuals on a more horizontal basis, more flexible in nature, can do the same organizing work that is currently done by these fixed hierarchies. And thanks to Shearer for drawing this video to my attention.
In the grassroots economy of 2018, you are a player in creating the products, services, and experiences that you and your friends enjoy. You have the power and a voice in making decisions that affect how stuff gets made, not just the big companies. It used to be that only the big companies could organize people, money, resources, and ideas effectively on a large scale to make clothes and video games, produce music, run hotels, and provide car loans. Today, anyone with a cell phone, a laptop, an internet connection can share ideas, form communities, collaborate, and produce. The big news in 2018 is that the engine of production shifted from a few companies at the top to everyone at the bottom. In the bottom-up model, you participate by contributing ideas, voting on designs, sharing resources, and acting collectively in a way that everyone's actions add up to something bigger, to something that couldn't be accomplished alone. Connecting everyone together into networks of exchange has made the little guy the big guy in the grassroots economy. And you aren't just a customer buying things, you're a producer, a creator, and a contributor to economic activity that used to be reserved for the people and companies who had the most control. Today in 2018, more than half of your clothes come from design collectives on the web. These are networks of students, designers, and fashion-conscious shoppers who contribute clothing designs and vote on which ones ought to be manufactured. Your last design was selected, which meant that you also got to pick the company to do the manufacturing job, a green certified small business that offers health care and affordable wages. When your little sister needed to get a loan to buy her first car, you didn't even consider the bank. They won't even look at someone without a credit history. You helped her find a loan from Prosper Market, an online financial network that matches people who are willing to lend money with people who need to borrow money, at terms they agree upon. In 2018, there's the mindset that giving is good. Contributing to collective efforts and sharing resources can lead to opportunity and change. If you figure out a cool hack for the iPhone, you don't keep it for yourself. You share it on the web. In today's grassroots economy, your value is measured not only by what you have, but by what you contribute and create. Money is still important, but so are your ideas, your ratings and votes, your creativity, your contributions. These are tracked and counted and reflect your power as a player in the grassroots economy. In fact, instead of getting a credit card bill showing what you spent, you get a monthly statement of value creation listing all the things you've contributed to or produced. So all those ratings of songs and news articles, those t-shirt designs you gave away, the iPhone hack you shared, it all gets added up and drives the grassroots economy.
And where this video is spot on is with the mentality that giving is good. That's an outright rejection of the traditional economic ethos, but one which I think has to take over. Ultimately, the mind shift of sharing and giving is what really matters, but the technology used in the right way may be a major aid bringing this about.
This and all previous episodes of the show are available for download from our MP3 archive, which is unwelcomeguests.net/archive. There's also a mailing list for any discussion of the show at altruists.org/unwelcome. The music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can. Another brave man.